You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 6, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865-1915, the curator of political and military history at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, John Grinspan, will be joining us today. Also on the program today, 20 states surpassed the 70% vaccination rate. 15 million of those people missed their second dose. Meanwhile, as of June, more than 99% of the COVID deaths in that month were from unvaccinated people. Meanwhile, in Missouri, hospitalizations spike because they are one of those states where they have minimal vaccination rates. U.S. forces leave Afghanistan, Afghan airport in the dead of night, largest air base in the country. As U.S. forces prepare to leave by August. We are now entering the inflection point on Biden's agenda. It's just days away to determine what moves they'll make on the infrastructure bill as progressives start to push the Medicare expansion. The gas pipeline leaves a huge inferno. A gas pipeline leak sparks a huge inferno in the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, the Dakota Access Pipeline protester saboteur sentenced to 8 years in prison. The pro-Trump social media platform that was launched last week was hacked on its launch day. A key witness in the Assange extradition case recants. Unclear how it will impact its Assange's prosecution. Biden White House pull back on sanctions as a weapon. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you had a good day yesterday and a happy 4th of July. And a welcome back as well to Emma Vigeland, who is on vacation. A little soggy.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunate. It's unfortunate. It was a not very sunny vacation. But you know what? I went bowling. I did well. So there's that.
Oh, all right. Don't leave us hanging. What does well mean?
Well, I don't remember my score because I had some drinks.
All right. And was this candlepin bowling or was this the...
It was not. It was not. But that was a question because I was in that, you know, New England area, which I don't even, you know what that is. But apparently that's the way to go.
That's the kind of bowling that we do up there with candlepins.
Yeah. No, it was just standard.
Wait, what? The
curvy. Candlepins are just like short of... I don't know what they're... They're shaped like a long pill almost. Mm. I don't know why. I mean, I didn't grow up thinking there was anything like candlepin bowling was candlepin bowling. That was it.
Yeah, it's that and roundabouts. You guys love that in Massachusetts for some reason.
Well, we call them rotaries. So, but yeah, we call them rotaries because they're good.
Yeah, got it. No, they're not. They're awful. Just like candlepin.
Actually, I got to defend rotaries. That's good road safety.
Yeah, the key is you just got to be aggressive. I mean, they say yield to the rotary. Yeah, that's you're not supposed to do that.
Just blow through.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's one of those moments where it's just like, whoever's going to win is going to win here, and that's it. Like it's just it's basically your insurance rates as you enter it.
Go Sox.
Whoever's got the
that was bad.
Cruddy a car wins the rotary. we should also say on Candlepin, yeah, it is a smaller ball.
I mean, why like
hold it in your palm?
I don't understand that. You're just messing with a good thing. I mean, bowling, it's pretty universal, and then that would throw me off entirely in terms of weight and hands and everything.
That's why you got to mix it up. Folks, let's turn to the news of the day. We are, I mean, the two big stories going forward are going to be the impact of July 4th weekend on those states that have low vaccination rates. The Delta variant, I think we said a couple of weeks ago, it had doubled to 20%. It's probably closer to 40% now in terms of all cases around the country. It's a little bit tricky to tell because we don't have a great system to assess the nature of variants. But to the extent that we can tell, it seems to be somewhere around 40%. It is anticipated that it will be the majority of infections in this country not too long from now. And the overwhelming number of deaths that are coming from COVID are now coming from unvaccinated people. And to the extent that there have been breakthrough infections that have led to hospitalizations and illnesses, that usually happens in the most vulnerable populations that exist regardless of vaccination. In other words, older folks over 65, 75, over 85 who have been vaccinated, to the extent that there are any people, and there really are so few who are dying who are vaccinated, it is people who are elderly and very continue to be the most susceptible to COVID in our population, broadly speaking. And so, and just, you know, a word of caution, there's a big report out of Israel that I know made my daughter nervous, that that the vaccination there, Pfizer vaccination, I think, I believe it is, 65% effective against the Delta variant, which is still incredibly high. And that is just for breakthrough infections. Again, in terms of serious illness from COVID and death, very, very low. Hospitalization and death, very low. No sense of whether your chances of getting a long-term COVID problem, long haulers, as they say, if you're vaccinated, we just don't know yet because the data is not in. But that's going to be one of the stories going forward in the month of July, because when we get 2 weeks out from 4th of July, we remember how that goes. That's when you start to see the infections and the beginning of the hospitalizations. And then the other story is within 2 weeks, we're going to have what is happening with the infrastructure bill is going to happen, essentially. The bipartisan bill still seems to be around. Mitch McConnell desperate to try and figure out a way to sink it, and to the point where he's saying, even though the president has no strategy of linking, and even though there are Democrats who have said, like, I won't vote for this unless I get that as well, which is not a necessarily top-down strategy, Mitch McConnell has said, we're going to filibuster the bipartisan bill unless there is no linkage. And I just don't know how that's supposed to resonate with anybody. We'll see. He is nervous about both bills passing. And just one note on...
Go on, Sam. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say one more thing, that it is clear in the bigger infrastructure bill, it seems like a lowered Medicare age is not going to happen. What appears to be happening is an expansion of Medicare benefits as they exist today. Unfortunate. Frankly, I would have liked both, and drop the Medicare age 50, 55, just getting more and more people into this single payer system. But go ahead, Emma.
Yeah, no, I mean, if the Democrats are smart, they will essentially say, okay, fine. I know that's a huge if. They're going to wrap whatever hard infrastructure was going to be in this bipartisan package and just put it in the reconciliation bill, and then McConnell has no play. I mean, you know, what is he really holding over Democrats' heads here? But what he knows is that that 50 vote threshold for the Democrats is, you know, they're walking a very thin line, and a lot can go wrong if they're going to try to do one massive reconciliation package.
Right. I mean, that's the bottom line. The question is, you know, do Manchin and Sinema feel like they have enough cover from what Mitch McConnell's saying to crash a Democratic reconciliation bill? But, you know, one upside potentially in the event that McConnell does crash it, and Manchin and Sinema are like, well, we did our best. I mean, that's ridiculous. You can't hold one piece of legislation based upon the way that people are going to vote for another piece of legislation. That's absurd. But we'll see. It's possible. The bipartisan bill functions as a cap on all of these different silos of so-called hard infrastructure. So in other words, these numbers are off the top of my head. The Biden administration, I think, wanted $65 billion for broadband. Well, the bipartisan bill says, I think, $15 or $20 billion. There is no mechanism to increase that. The reconciliation bill will not be used to increase that. That bill functions as a cap. And that is, you know, one of the ways in which I would imagine, you know, Manchin and Sinema, you know, were using that as a way of enticing Republicans. But we will see. All right, let's just turn to this clip. This I found rather amazing. We are now in an era where people are coming back to work to some extent. We still have a lot of things that hold people back in terms of babysitters and scheduling and whatnot. But people are coming back to work based upon the numbers that we saw last month in terms of new employment figures. But the other dynamic that's happening right now is that people have used this past year to reevaluate what's important to them in their lives. There's a lot of people who are saying, I'm not going back for that low wage job that was dead end. I'm just not going to do it. I've maybe found other ideas on how I can make money. Maybe I can find a different job. Maybe it's just not worth it for me to eke out the arbitrage between the childcare and the job. Maybe I'll go without certain things because I want to stay home with the kids. Whatever it is, people are saying, I don't want to live in that rat race. Maybe I don't want to live in the city. Too tough. Rather go live in a suburban or rural area because I'm not going to make as much money, but I'm not going to have to work as hard. There's a lot
of
people.
Or I'm not going to have to pay as much in rent.
Or I'm not going to have to pay as much in rent. Exactly. You know, the cost of living is lower. I mean, there's a whole raft of things that people are reevaluating about their lives right now, which makes sense, total sense. And that is highly problematic for people who rely on all these people to come in and be worker bees. And here's Donny Deutsch, guy who made his bones in this world by starting out working on a railroad where he would actually hammer in the nails, the spikes into the railroad track. Oh, wait a second.
And then at night he would shovel coal, right? That's what I heard. I mean, he didn't sleep.
Let's listen to Donny Deutsch.
What I see and what I feel is there's something changed in the American psyche of what I'll call just kind of the work ethic. And it's not just the $300 check. I think post-pandemic, people got used to staying at home. CNBC had a thing that they call the Great Resignation, that I think there's something like statistically 92% of Americans said they're either considering change jobs or leave their jobs. And I think that we've gotten a little soft in the pandemic. I love that James Gorman, the head of Morgan Stanley, said to his workers, I'm not going to give you the option. This is a separate issue about people not having jobs. This is about people going back to work. I'm not going to give you the option of coming back to work. If you feel okay going to a New York City restaurant, you can go back to work. And I'm one of these believers of this kind of this new soft attitude of, oh, work from home, flexibility or whatnot. There's something about people going back to work that has to happen. And if I was still running a company today, I would say, guess what? You're coming back to work. So there's two problems. So there are people who don't want to work. And there's the people who don't want to go back physically to work. And we've softened in the pandemic. And that's a concern to me.
if he was still running a company, maybe, you know, he wouldn't be so soft himself, right? If he's lecturing everybody else on coming back to work, where's he? He seems to be zooming from home. I don't know. Or maybe blue wall is
pretty
is
hard scrabble, pretty hard scrabble background that he has there. Just to be clear, Donnie Deutsch joined his dad's advertising firm in 1983. 6 years later, because of how hard he worked, probably, his dad gave him full control of the agency. And then 21 years later, he sold the company for $265 million. I have no doubt that he worked very, very hard during that time as, having his own advertising agency. And in 20 years, he gets to retire or do whatever he wants. Whatever he wants. In other words, nobody's dictating to him that he has to go into work. If he goes into work, it's because he wants to. No one's dictating anything to him. And he sits there. I don't know why he's not in the studio at MSNBC there, but he sits in his $2 million, $3 million. Who knows how nice that apartment he is in, or maybe he's in a hotel. I have no idea. But the idea that these people are praising Goldman Sachs and anybody else for sort of, you know, cracking the whip, the idea that we define in our society as going soft, the idea that, like, you know what, quality of life is more important to me than going in and joining this rat race.
Goldman Sachs just come out and it was leaked an internal document that their analysts, 80% of them, something like that, have mental health issues given the treatment at that company? Like, I mean, there's really no connection between productivity and coming into work and working hard, as he says, or driving them. I mean, but like, it's all about just exercising control, not creating. Yeah,
I'm not convinced. Well, and I think it was Morgan Stanley, maybe he said, but either way, I'm sure that that working in that environment is not healthy. And I don't know that it isn't more productive to come into work or stay at home. But what is really the point, and you're making this point, is that this is about control. Rather than letting the workers dictate the way that they want to lead their lives, he's saying something's got to happen to regain that control. And I don't know what he's got in mind, but let's hope that it doesn't. Let's hope that people can fashion a life for themselves that they think is more pleasant. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to John Greenspan. He's the author of The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. We'll be right back after these words. Folks, do you care about your internet security? I do. I don't think I'm overly, uptight about it, but it's like, if you have an easy way to make sure that what you're doing online is secure, particularly, we got these stories. I mean, I don't know that I'm a big fish in this world but you have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of ransomware that is going out there. Eventually, they're going to figure out that it's easier to go after just all sorts of random people. Well, the beauty of ExpressVPN is that it basically prevents you from being seen by your internet service providers. Internet service providers sell this information to companies, tech giants. They use your data to target you. And who knows what else? ExpressVPN creates a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so people can't peep on your online activity. It works on phones, works on laptops. It works even on routers. So everyone who shares your pass, your Wi-Fi can be protected. Super easy to use. You just fire up the app. You click one button. You browse as normal. ExpressVPN is rated number one by CNET, Wired, and The Verge. Also a good way to maybe let a streaming service in a foreign country think that you're in that area and get to see a whole host of programs that aren't available in the U.S. Then that becomes like, why can't we see those? Anyways, I don't want you to go down that rabbit hole. The bottom line is you can protect yourself with ExpressVPN, and this is a super, super easy way to do it. Like I say, fire up the app, you click one button. Secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/majority today. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority. You can get an extra 3 months free, ExpressVPN.com/majority. Also, summer months, you don't want to smell bad, but if you're like me, you also don't want to put any crap into your body. Things like aluminum or God knows what, which is why I was so psyched when I found Native. Sometimes, you know, you need to protect yourself. I've already talked in the past, like, you know, back in the day, didn't use any deodorant because I was afraid. You didn't really have any options. It was either you're going to put that garbage into your glands or not. Well, now no one has to because Native has your back. Native cares about the products you put on your body. They're all about stopping the stink the right way. You probably already know about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant, but they also have body wash, toothpaste, and their brand new mineral-based sunscreen. I had a good experience actually rubbing this on Saul. Like, there's many of them that he does not like because they're greasy. But this one, he sort of allowed me to put it on his face without biting my hand. Native Broad Spectrum SPF 30 sunscreen is lightweight. It absorbs quickly, and you can choose between unscented or coconut and pineapple. Kids like the coconut and pineapple. Dad likes the unscented. You can get their deodorant and body wash in amazing scents like coconut vanilla, citrus herbal musk, lavender and rose, and of course, Dad's favorite, the unscented. Can't have the smell, folks. Sorry. You can even build your own personalized product bundles. Mix and match three of your favorite scents. Keep them on rotation so you got something for every occasion. It never even occurred to me that people would do that. But that makes sense, actually. Stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedo.com/majority report or use the promo code majority report at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedo.com/majority report or use the promo code majority report at checkout for 20% off your first order. And lastly, for the day, I don't know if these guys monitor the show and then decide when they're going to deploy these ads. Like, we don't choose when the ads come. Like, we get them from the media broker. But they seem to do it, like, almost now every day I shave. And I shave, I don't know if I have a schedule, but I feel like I must be on some type of schedule. It's weird. Maybe I'm reading too much into that. But bottom line is, with Harry's, you don't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price. And now Harry's is offering listeners their starter set at harrys.com/majority. We've talked about Harry's for years now. They deliver a close shave, a comfortable shave, and they do so at a fair price, still as low as $2 per refill. Their blades are designed to stay sharp. Apparently, they did a recent study. Guys who shave four times a week said their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. And so for me, that lasts like 2 weeks. If I've shaved four times in 2 weeks, I feel like I'm doing it right. And they always seem to advertise on days I've shaved. Harry's bought a factory in Germany. They make precision engineered blades, and they've done so for over 100 years. Then Harry's design team combined a weighted ergonomic handle with their signature blade cartridge. It's a smart, simple razor. It's designed for delivering a close shave all along the contours of your face. My favorite aspects of the razor, of course, the trimmer shave head and the handles. Because you can get really nice sort of classic looking handles. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much they have a 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. Harry's is giving their best offer to Majority Report listeners. New Harry's customers get a starter set at harrys.com/majority. You get a 5-blade razor. You get a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover, all a $13 value for just $3. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer today. We will always put the coupon code, the codes in our podcast and YouTube description. So I'd like to welcome to the program, curator of political and military history at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, author of The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. John Grinspan, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, well, I'm a big fan of both the Smithsonian and your book. So thanks for joining us. This is, in some ways, your book is an attempt to sort of, I guess, look at this era of the Gilded Age in a different light. Tell us about how that is.
Yeah, I guess over the last several years, we've heard people throw around the word unprecedented a lot. And I started to feel like there's this incredible era in American history that holds a lot of precedence for many of the things we're going through today. Anxieties about partisanship, political violence, voter suppression, voter turnout. And it's a really rich era in the late 19th century when there's a huge crisis of democracy and kind of a fight to fix democracy that ultimately gives birth to many of our norms, many of the things we consider normal politics. This is the origin story for it. So this book tries to kind of explain to people how we got to whatever normal looked like. It's gone now, but what was the birth of it? How did we get to the era of what we consider kind of calm civil politics? That was created out of a previous crisis. And so I wanted to tell that story.
And we should say the Gilded Age is basically the last 30 years of the 19th century. 1870 to about 1900, I think is more or less the era that we're talking about. And you chose to also, in addition, sort of as a through line, to talk about one particular family, the Kelly family. Tell us about Pig Iron Kelly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this incredible through line through this history, through from the Civil War, Reconstruction, Gilded Age, well into the 20th century. There's this one father-daughter dynasty, basically, that's kind of fighting for abolition, workers' rights, women's suffrage, ending child labor. And they just show up everywhere. The father, William Pig Iron Kelly, is a radical congressman who writes the language of the 15th Amendment, giving African-Americans the right to vote. His daughter is key in passing anti-child labor legislation that we benefit from today and getting Social Security going. And they kind of befriended half the population of the country, the Abe Lincolns and the Frederick Douglasses and the W.E.B. Du Boises, and pissed off and fought with the other half. So they were just a really nice vehicle for telling this big history. And there aren't that many father-daughter dynasties in our history. So I thought it was fun to highlight their ups and downs and their assassination attempts and their fights and all of that.
And particularly then. I would imagine not so many. Not that many now, but particularly even then.
Will Kelly assumes his daughter will never be able to vote and raises her to be a politician in her own way anyway. And it's just an incredible story.
All right. Well, let's start. I mean, give us a sense of let's start with early Kelly and talk about where he starts out. Now, this is coming out of. There's, I guess, technically speaking, right, a slight overlap between the Gilded Age and Reconstruction. And where was Kelly on Reconstruction? And we should just remind people that Reconstruction, the era following the Civil War, where the Republicans, the then radical Republicans, were hoping to impose some rather big changes, very positive in my perspective, on America. And Johnson largely thwarted them and following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, almost was impeached, largely because of that, although there were other reasons. So where was Kelly in that moment?
Kelly is on the extreme radical fringe of the radical Republicans. He starts off as this working class Philadelphia politician, and he basically makes it his through line to protect working people throughout his long career, throughout from 1814 to 1890. And he sees slaves and African-Americans as falling into the category of working people. So he's fighting segregation in Philadelphia streetcars. He's introducing the first bill for African-American voting rights on a federal level before slavery is even fully abolished with the 13th Amendment. And he's, you know, traveling the South, giving speeches, getting shot at by KKK mobs who are opposing him well up through the 1870s, when he's really fighting for a lot of the values that we would hopefully hold today at a time when they're deeply unpopular with certain populations. And so his whole political career is really hard fought because there's a lot of opposition to these values of kind of expanding democracy.
And in that era, you write that voter participation is at an all-time high. I mean, explain to us, like, what was the sort of, I guess, the feeling, and also, you know, politics were pretty raucous at that time.
Yeah. I mean, we say voter turnout was record in every election, but really, if you want record voter turnout, you have to go back to the 1860s, 1870s, when 80% of eligible voters are going to the polls, really just blowing out of the water anything we've seen in our lifetime. And those denied the right to vote, women, African-Americans, people under 21, are still in the streets arguing the issues, reading the newspapers, fighting it out. Campaigns back then were deeply public and kind of revolved around torchlit marches at midnight with people singing songs, waving torches, drinking whiskey, throwing bricks. There's a way that politics is kind of the center of public entertainment at the time, as well as making the big decisions for American life. And we know from our own era how when you mix those two things together, entertainment and politics, the results can be really explosive. So we kind of sleep on this era, but I think it's the most interesting and most vibrant and dynamic. And you go through the Smithsonian collections, we have the torches and the banners and the uniforms from these rival, almost paramilitary political gangs that are fighting each other in the street each election.
And we're also seeing here in the, you know, now kind of a different approach to, say, inflation, right? Or the deficit, whereas we saw in that era kind of a transition period with the gold standard as well. Like, what was Kelly's approach to that? And how involved was he in that transition?
Yeah, what's really interesting is you can kind of understand how these people are fighting each other over democracy or race or equal rights. But they're also fighting each other over the gold standard and the tariff, you know, fighting in the street over it. Will Kelly comes to believe that there's a huge depression in the 1870s, and the only way to help working people is to increase the money in society. And so he starts pushing these plans called the Greenbacker plans to basically have more money in society, because it's all being kind of held onto by the rich. So he wants to kind of help fight income inequality through just having more money. And then later, he gets his nickname Pig Iron because he wants to use tariffs and protective fees on imports to America to help American manufacturers and help American industry. And he kind of goes off on all these crazy schemes that aren't things that really fire us up today, but at the time drove American politics for a while. So he has his hand in all these different movements, from the end of abolition and the end of slavery, the increase in voting rights, up through kind of building an industrial economy and trying to protect workers in that economy. He shows up everywhere you want him to be, kind of. And so as a historian, he was a fun guy to start to tell his story, because he's just on time, right where you want him to be.
Wait, now what was driving? I mean, I can, on one level, I can understand that you have like intense partisan feeling at this time, right? Because largely Democrats were fighting to protect the institution and the economic system that was built up around slavery. The North is fighting to end it on some level, and to, I guess, basically just, you know, make the South be part of the country, not succeed. So that partisanship, I can understand, sort of, you know, lingers, right? I mean, the one day the guns stop firing, but I would imagine the resents continue. Was that basically the main driver of why there was this level of intensity? Or was it also that there was a continued, that everybody had agendas at that point that were actually meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is there's so many drivers, right? They're fighting over race, they're fighting over slavery, but Reconstruction ends tragically in 1877, and they keep fighting for the next 20 years. Even as race and slavery kind of fall away from the national agenda, they're fighting over public schools, immigration, whiskey, all these issues that are driven, I think, at bottom by something that drives our political conflicts today, which is economic inequality and disruption and instability. That to live in Gilded Age America, whether you're born as a slave and have to make a life in freedom, or whether you're born in Ireland or Eastern Europe and have to make a life for the Chicago slaughterhouse, you have a lot of disruption, instability. You don't have communities you can hold on to. You're disconnected from your family. Your lives are getting harder. You know, mortality rates are going up. Americans are shorter in this era than in previous eras because they're getting diseases. They have bad diets. They live in filthy cities. So their lives are just shaken, and they're looking for something. They need a new tribe. And there are these two political parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And they're fundamentally different, but you might as well consider them kind of tribe X and tribe Y, because what people really want is membership. And so they'll dive into whatever tribe makes sense for them, for their religious community or their background or their class or their race. And then they'll kind of turn out to march and fight and vote because it's their tribe. And they want something that gives them a sense of membership. The way I think a lot of people today who feel disrupted, who suffer from income inequality, really look to these parties to offer some kind of new home, a new community that's being eroded in the rest of society.
I want to get to the election of Hayes and sort of the compromise that was involved in that and ending Reconstruction in a moment. But just to that last point, how much of the issue sets that were being fought over 20 years out were surrogates for that earlier fight? In other words, there was a consistency, wasn't there? I mean, like when you start to hear about, you know, different types of taxes or immigrants or workers' hours, I mean, they seem to be surrogates for the fights that they were having that they had in the Civil War. I mean, it being around race and slavery and about, you know, who's going to have power and control over society.
Yeah. I mean, no issues go away, right? They don't resolve any of these problems. So the fights of 1860 are still going on in 1885. But as you get into the Gilded Age, into the 1880s, younger people start saying, as they say, I don't care about the cut of trousers in 1861. Those are old issues. I don't care about secession. Especially in the North, they say, I just don't care about the South anymore. It's a minority region. It's not that powerful. You can't get my vote based on that. But they might equally hate Democrats because of tariff rates or attitudes toward unionization. They're still at each other's throats. They just keep adding on new issues. Just as today, I mean, we have all these fundamental issues that overlap and kind of reinforce each other. There's not one big ultimate issue that kind of determines everything. They just keep kind of balling in together with further issues. And so the parties never come to any kind of resolution as a result, because they just keep adding to conflict.
Let's talk about the election of was it Rutherford B. Hayes?
Yep.
Ended Reconstruction. Will you walk us through that? And also, and then we can also talk the implication of the voter suppression that sort of made that whole deal necessary, it seems to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we start with the end of the election. We start about the end of Reconstruction, but we should start with the fact that it's the highest turnout election in American history ever, including any election we've seen in our times. And that's bearing in mind all the voter suppression, all the fact that there are tons and tons, probably a million African-American Republicans in the South, many of whom are voting with their lives at stake and not voting because of, you know, white Democrat KKK members at the polls with shotguns. This is a really bloody election. There's tons of voter suppression. Someone fires a gun through the window of Rutherford B. Hayes while he's eating with his family. There's a lot of conflict going on. And what happens, as we've become familiar with, is there's a clear popular vote winner. The Democrats win clearly the popular vote. This guy, Samuel Tilden, who is not that exciting a candidate, but clearly wins. But the electoral vote is still up for decision in four key states. And they kind of fight it out on the ground. And what you see is one party stealing the vote from another party and the other party stealing it right back, basically. They all have their preferred mechanisms for how to steal an election. And in the end, the Republicans managed to win the presidency. And that's really important. But they barter away a number of things in the process, and Reconstruction essentially ends at that point. But the thing I'd like to stress is that American voters really were ready. The majority of American voters, white voters in the Democratic Party and some in the Republican Party, really were done with Reconstruction. So the problem here at the end of Reconstruction, it's not just that a few politicians made a deal. It's that a large number of white Americans abandoned Reconstruction. I think there's a tendency to put it on, you know, these five guys in a room. But we see this betrayal of numbers of large numbers of voters who vote against Reconstruction in the 1870s and give up on this promise that they'd kind of made with these constitutional amendments.
And is that just, you know, exhaustive, like they're just exhausted from it? Or, I mean, what drives that kind of abandonment outside of, I mean, you could say leadership from the top once Lincoln was gone. But I mean, there's got to be more structural issues that drive that tendency.
Yeah.
What are those?
I mean, there are a bunch. There's a huge depression around then. The Great Depression of 1873 is called the Great Depression until 1929 comes along. And there are a lot of people in the North who just don't care that much about Civil War or the South anymore. Some of them are still deeply racist and never really liked the idea of helping African-Americans that much to begin with. There's really a betrayal of this old commitment. They lose interest. They move on. People like Will Kelly, who, you know, fought and bled to end slavery and give African-Americans voting rights, basically by that point says, you know, it's all settled. We're done. There's a really sad turning here. And I think there's a lesson for today on how quickly voters who support an idea can turn their back on it. You know, working on this book, watching how people were voting, it is frustrating and a little upsetting watching how quickly voters can abandon a commitment they've made before. And right. This opens up this next era where African-Americans really lose political rights. I'm sorry, Sam.
Well, but does Tilden lose if you don't have this massive wave of voter suppression of Black people? I mean, it's one thing to say that, you know, that people got frustrated. I would imagine it's frustration as much as it is being tired of Reconstruction, because Reconstruction was sort of spinning its wheels, right? They didn't really front load it in the way that I think a lot of the radical Republicans wanted to in Congress because of Johnson. And there was no response, it seems to me, by the federal government to these, you know, tens of massacres that were around, you know, like massive massacres that in some places completely changed the trajectory of the political leadership there. But if those million Black voters who should have been able to vote and had maybe Reconstruction been front loaded in the way that it should have, they would have been able to vote. We get a very different outcome, don't we?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's about Tilden wins by about 250,000 votes. There are supposed to be 1 million Black voters in the South. But the thing is also that the Republican Party, a large portion of it had given up on Reconstruction, too. So even if the good guys won, even if the Republican Party in the 1870s won, you'd still see this. The next couple presidents, they step back, and Republican presidents, they still just don't fight on the ground, as you were saying, to kind of address these massacres, address this voter suppression. Basically, there's one core that wants to continue fighting for voting rights in the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is entirely hostile. And the people who in the middle, these Republican majority, they just aren't going to fight anymore. Like, it's not something they're opposed to loudly and vocally, but they want to fight over economic issues or immigration. They kind of turn their blind eye to the South. And you can see what happens in a result. These voter suppression laws, the kind of rise of Jim Crow. It happens because states can do what they want without federal oversight anymore.
And how much does what's happening with the Supreme Court and their allowing for these voter suppression laws? Like, I'm just trying to look at, like, figure out what is the, you know, what's responding to what and who's responding to who. Like, you know, Kelly, it seems like maybe the writing's on the wall that the electorate is not going to be there to support this.
Yeah.
But it's also of like, you tell me that the electorate constitutes this many Black voters and this many white voters versus a quarter of those Black voters and all these same white voters. I'm going to have a different sense of what the electorate's going to respond to. And as the Supreme Court starts to allow voter suppression, it seems to me like this is just the writing's on the wall and my political future doesn't lie here on some level.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I listened to you speaking with David Blight yesterday, and he talks about this. So there's just this, within a couple of years, this real deterioration, and the Supreme Court is leading the way in a lot of that. And if you're a congressman, if you're Will Kelly, and you look around, and he represents West Philadelphia, there are all these row houses full of basically middle and working class white laborers. And there's some African-Americans, but they're not that many. He's thinking, as a congressman thinks, as an elected official thinks, how do I keep getting elected? And they're continuous political campaigns, and they're losing. The Democratic Party, this party that had previously been tied to slavery and secession, it wins back Congress in one of the biggest landslides ever in 1874. The writing is on the wall, as you say. It looks like the forces of campaigning, the forces of winner-take-all elections, the forces of constantly having to hold on to your seat and hold on to power are pushing these politicians who had great goals a decade before into chasing the votes. And I think that's mostly what happens. And I say that because I don't want to let the American voters off the hook a little bit. There are large numbers of voters who wipe their hands of this titanic struggle that they'd been engaged in before. And I think we need to, in our own era, be kind of cognizant of how that can happen.
And then it feels like the exhaustion of that era leads an opening to sort of anti-democratic forces, I guess you could say. That Francis Parkman, tell us about that op-ed, I guess it is. It's sort of just perfectly timed. Now that we've dealt with Reconstruction, can we really reevaluate this whole concept of everybody voting? Because, man, that was a hassle.
Yeah, it sure was a hassle. He says, this is a famous historian in Boston, and he's really respected as a historian, but he writes this article, The Failure of Universal Suffrage, in 1878, that says, democracy doesn't work. Equality is a bad idea. Not everyone is created equal, and majorities are usually wrong. So what we need to do is find some way around democracy, because what happens is it's allowing basically working class people and immigrants and African Americans to dominate the polls. We need to stop listening to this majority. And this is a time when, you know, people who are less educated and less well off voted at higher rates than people who are more educated. The kind of people who were elites in society, they said a gentleman never votes, or bother politics, just kind of dismissing all engagement. And he's saying majorities are wrong, democracy doesn't work, and we need to fundamentally change how we choose power, how we delineate power in our society, because these people are just going to outvote us every time because they've got the numbers. And there's really, I don't want to sound like I'm endorsing this because it's really essentially heinous and anti-democratic. There's a voice coming out, turning after the 1870s against widespread mass democracy and mass participation. And more Americans start saying, do we need this turnout? Do we need this high engagement? And they ultimately create a new political system that has much less turnout. And they really manage to tamp down and suppress and discourage African-Americans, young people, poor people, working class people from voting in those large numbers that they previously had. And what's amazing is you can see it start with one bad election. 1876, everything goes wrong. And you can see the 50 years of kind of rising engagement in democracy start to peak and fall after that. And I think after 2020, we might want to be cognizant of what one bad election can lead to.
John, I got to say, it's impossible for me to imagine that we would have a society where we would where our leaders would try and diminish the opportunity for people to vote. That is
crazy,
so
right?
Far-fetched. I couldn't even conceive of such a thing. So So what were the mechanisms that were used? I mean, we people can go back, and I think I spoke to Carol Anderson about this some time ago, about the Supreme Court at that time was, you know, imposing literary tests and poll taxes, and there was widespread desire to both make it difficult for Black people and, frankly, poor white people to vote at that time. What were the other things that were done to sort of, I guess, lessen the intensity and then the desire for people to come out and vote?
Yeah, there are kind of two interesting divergent paths in this area. And in the South, the elites who want to stop African-Americans from voting, essentially the underclass in the South that's voting in large numbers, they use, as you say, this literacy test, poll taxes, and that's all backed up by extreme levels of violence, the kind of the rise in lynchings, the presence of armed men at the polls. And they go, you know, in a few short years from things like having 130,000 voters in Louisiana to having 1,300 voters of African-American background in Louisiana. They really obliterate Black voting in a few years. Now, in the North, they take a different path. The elites and kind of the millionaires and the well-to-do in the North, the population they want to stop voting is working class white people, immigrants, kind of mobile, poorer people, and they can't just take their votes away. The Supreme Court won't let them disenfranchise people. So they settle on kind of discouragement. Politics is big and exciting and interesting, and they want to make it a hassle, a bother, a less exciting, less fun. They want really a revolution for more boring politics. So they introduce processes that'll mean lines at the polls. You start to vote in private on a government ballot as opposed to with the whole community into a ballot box with people shouting and yelling and drinking. They kind of end these big torchlit parades and they start handing out lots of educational literature. They say more thinking, less shouting is basically the mantra. And it works. Discouragement is almost as powerful in some ways as disenfranchisement. Turnout falls. It's 80% of voters in the 1890s to less than half of voters by the 1920s. They really erode voting by immigrants, working class people, young people. And once you cut it off for a generation, it stops continuing because they're not teaching their children to vote. So we see really low turnout across most of the 20th century from these previous heights because of this successful effort at discouraging and kind of quieting politics.
And who's voting at that time? Like, what's happening with the progressive movement? And the progressive movement has elements of that too, where it's sort of like a in loco parentis. I don't know the exact term for it, but it's at that point there is this sort of quality of like, let's let the professionals handle it on some
level. Yes, yeah, just expert leadership. The experts should be voting, not you. Florence Kelly, Will Kelly's daughter, who is, you know, really a righteous crusader for protecting children from, you know, suffering in factories and all these causes we would admire and have benefited from. She really hates voters. She says the voters and the politicians are really just a funnel for the experts to pour their ideas into practice. That it's really about experts, it's about studies, it's about sociologists and social scientists who really know better than those average voters anyway. And so even though she benefits social democracy in many ways, electoral democracy is not front of their list. And as turnout starts to fall, you don't really see this population bemoaning it. They aren't sad to see these new immigrant voters not going to the polls, because in many ways, it's easier to make reforms and make changes in a quiet democracy than in a loud one. And the bigger and louder the party conflict, the less they could ever get through. So they're kind of happy to see voter turnout fall, because then they can actually make some of those changes that, interestingly enough, are beneficial. So it's not they're not evildoers, right? They're just, they have different motivations than us in many ways.
They're anti-democratic.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that is, you know, it depends on, I guess, like what is, you know, what becomes the, you know, what is the key principle that you're, that you're hanging your hat on in that moment. And do we see also in that era, the professionalization? I know maybe came a little bit later, but I think it was around this time we also start to see towards the end. I mean, are we technically still in the Gilded Age until through the 10s and the 20s?
People argue progressive era. Yeah.
The progressive era. Some people argue that we're still in that Gilded Era.
Yeah.
But that progressive era brings in, you know, stuff like city managers and local election reforms that make government less responsive, essentially, to the people.
Yeah, they have fewer elections. They have at-large leadership. They have all these things that kind of are designed to break up the power of campaigns and of bosses, and also to remove politicians, especially Congress, from the people. That they stop it. Throughout American history, the size of Congress had expanded with the population, right? Because you want it somewhat proportionate. In 1911, they stop at 435 Congress people, and we still have that today. You know, for the last century, the population of this country is three times larger than it was, but we still have the same number of Congress people. So they're all proportionately that much more distant. These are all kind of legacies. They introduced the filibuster in the Senate for real use in 1917. These are all legacies of this point in time when they want politics to be quieter, more restrained, easier. People stop thinking about electoral law as much. We talk all the time now about kind of voter suppression and what the law is in Georgia versus what the law is in Arizona. This really kind of is what they talked about up through this era. And then it kind of pulls back a lot for a while. People are much more private about their politics, private about their partisan beliefs. There's just a removal of the American people from electoral democracy in many ways.
Is that part of the dynamic that kind of leads to the permanent fixture of the, you know, 435 members of the House of Representatives at some time later, right, in 1930 or so?
No, it's right then. It's 1911. They stop expanding it. And then, you know, we still have 435 to this day, which is astounding. It used to be if
it's
you traveled.
Yeah. We should, I guess, theoretically have about 1,400 lawmakers if we were keeping up with the ratios. And there's no law, right? I mean, there's no mechanism to inhibit it. It's just like it just fell out of favor.
Yeah, and if you read the diaries and letters of people in the 19th century, they get on a train and they sit down next to their congressman and they talk to them. Or there are a lot of young people who first learn about politics because they're on a steamboat and their congressman is riding on the same steamboat and they start talking. There's just a lot more. You go to the saloon and you meet your representative. There's just a lot more interaction and a lot more influence. And in the absence, money and power is what influences these congressmen, because they're not bumping into their constituents, they're bumping into donors. So, yeah, there's a huge change in this era. And their benefits, we get all this positive legislation, but it really erodes participation and engagement.
Well, how much of that, though, is like their desire to essentially, as you say, narrow it specifically to moneyed interests so that they don't have to worry about kind of these different constituencies? And that's more of an afterthought as opposed to, you know, we can go to these specific big wigs and they're going to help me get reelected, et cetera.
Yeah, I think there are two motivations there. One is it's always nice to have money on your side, and to only have to talk to these few donors is easier. Running the previous campaigns was a ton of labor to get people to march and vote and hand out ballots and, you know, fight in the street in your name took a lot of work. And they really want to calm that down because they don't want to be engaged with the kind of people who are handing out ballots and hollering your name in the street. So they kind of fall back in some ways on big money because it's just easier for them to find 10 donors than to find 10,000 marchers. So, you know, there's a lot going on with income inequality. This is the Gilded Age. They have a lot of motivations. But one is that they want to find a replacement for the big, loud, old style of campaigning.
So the paradox here is that there may be good legislation that we get at that time that is somewhat progressive because of the nature of, I guess, some of the intentions, you know, where there was this sort of paternal feeling by a lot of these politicians. But it completely erodes the responsiveness of our government to the people. And much of that has been revived, right? I mean, that dynamic shifted a little bit, it seems to me, during the sort of the Great Compression from following World War II into the 70s, but only because you had rising economic power from the middle on some level, and then ultimately what became emancipation for a lot of people. But that erosion, like those steps have been sort of reintroduced in some level, right? I mean, voter suppression, moneyed interest in politics, et cetera. I mean, we're sort of replaying that era without the good intentions, it feels like.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like we had the worst of both 19th and 20th century democracy in some ways. Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to work on this book and see every day. I went back to the 19th century because I didn't really want to argue about the present. I love the way history can kind of expand our perspective. And then you can't ignore what's happening every day in the street, and you can't ignore what's happening every day in elections. So it seems like every election we do see these trends that I thought were buried 100 years ago reemerging. In addition, in terms of partisanship, political violence, distrust, all these forces that we've seen before reemerging. I guess the one saving grace is that we've seen those forces constrained in the past. And there's a paradox and there's a trade-off. But sometimes I feel like we talk about what's happening in our democracy today as some kind of inevitable downfall. But we've seen it up and down over our history. And I think there's value in seeing that, even if it's not always purely for good changes.
Right. It's not necessarily a downfall, but all right. Just broadly speaking, just to wrap it up, like what in a generic sense, what comes out of that? You lessen the power of the people. Generically speaking, what comes out of that era? I mean, discontent at one point, right? Because people are just nothing's being addressed.
You mean in the late 19th century or in the 20th century?
Well, in the 20th century, I guess.
I think what comes out of it is an attitude that democracy and politics is someone else's business, and you shouldn't talk about your beliefs, and you shouldn't engage, and the sense of kind of conformity and lack of engagement and apathy towards, you know, public life that we see throughout much of the 20th century, where people just say, oh, it's somebody else's problem. It's, you know, these kind of big presidents and executives who decide things, and lack of sense of personal ownership, on your democracy. And I think we've been seeing today, for good and for bad, as voter turnout rises, as civic engagement rises among young people, as we talk about democracy, voting laws, elections more, I do think we're expressing an ownership in our democracy that you haven't seen in America in 100 years. And so if you want to be optimistic, that's a positive trend, I guess.
Right. A lot less likely that politicians can ignore the existence of people and just end up driving things into a ditch like we saw in the 20s.
Yeah.
I always look to Flint as a good example of that. When you have the less democracy you have, the more chances are you're going to essentially run your population into a brick wall or disaster, it seems to me. And then there's pushback, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating era. John Grinspan. The book is The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. Thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Then we'll be back. Wrap it up. All right, folks, that's it for us today. If you watch us on the Peacock app, on the Choice channel, the Peacock app, we'll be back tomorrow. But some food for thought as we head into this era. It would be so much better, I think, if we did have 1,400, 800 even Congress people. And it would make, first of all, it would make gerrymandering a lot less relevant, it seems to me.
Right.
I need to do the math on that. But the idea that we have the same amount of representation that we did when the country was one third the size is just bizarre. And this is the House of Representatives as opposed to the Senate, which is supposed to be, essentially just the House of Lords. But
the smaller the number, the less money you have to pay to buy them off. So
that's also true. That makes it very convenient. All right, folks, we will say goodbye to our Peacock folks. See you tomorrow. And for those of you who are still with us, we're going to head into the fun half. Boy, do we got a lot of stuff for the fun half. Looking at my sheet of stuff right here. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you also get extra content. And now also, apparently, every membership, I'm not going to say that. I was thinking about the Crowder, but the guys in the hospital right now, I think. I just want to make it clear. I did nothing physical to him.
Right.
Nothing.
Well, if he's having any physical reactions, it's purely just in response to any emotional reaction he might have had to
exactly.
The debate. Right.
Exactly. It's the mind-body relationship. And
that's a little too Eastern for him. So,
yeah, but he's living it, right? I mean, is it a coincidence? I don't know. That
asking questions.
First off, let me just say this to folks. If you are feeling for an extended period of time coldness in your feet, go see your doctor. I mean, that is not your extremity should not be that cold. You put it off. This is what happens. So
you got to need some circulation down there, man.
Yeah, exactly. Don't forget, Nomi Show now twice a week. You can find that at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. Oh, here she is. Oh my God. It's Tuesday.
Tuesday.
I'm so messed up.
We you thought it was Monday. Week. Yeah.
I did. I thought it was Monday. Nomi will be here in a moment. Matt, in the meantime, why don't you tell us about the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Yeah, I'll make it quick because I have a double voice thing going on. But Victor Poggi talked about Brazil and Lula on Left Reckoning this week, and Austin from Machete Mate. We're going to talk about his trip to South America. So 8 Eastern, Wednesday night now. We moved to Wednesday, so.
Oh, you moved to Wednesday night? Wait, what's the double voice thing?
No, I'm mute. I'm mute when you talk, so, or I'm trying to do my best to do that. So.
Well, we'll see. There's a just OBS, I think, has my voice coming in twice. I think it sounds good, but...
it sounds fine to me.
Yeah.
Oh, but maybe it's loud out there. I see. Nomi!
What's up?
How are you doing? You feel like you're coming from like an astral plane. Like there doesn't she
I am actually
like floating on like some type of
we're
like,
astro projecting her. I guess.
Should I put some cushioning around this? Is that what's happening?
It looks like you're literally calling us from a cloud.
I mean, I'm a little bit in a cloud right now.
So, all right, the show. All right. Exciting news.
Exciting news. Yes, our show has moved to Wednesday and Friday. Evenings, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. So we put in just as much show. Everybody gets the same amount of show. It's just not Tuesday through Friday, like every single day, which, you know, I think makes it easier on a lot of people. And you get just as much of the show during the week. So subscribers, patrons, everybody gets 4 hours of show. So it's exciting. It's an evening slot. And a lot of the same folks will be on as regulars. We're going to have extended interviews a little bit longer because we just realized a lot of people wanted longer interviews. And just like when things were getting spicy, we were like, and now we have to go to our panel. So we're able to extend things out a little bit more, which is fun.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want
it's a better time slot too.
You don't want to close it down when the spice starts happening.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right.
So check us out Wednesday. And then of course the committee programs on Monday.
That's
as
right.
Well.
And is that still happening at 3 p.m.?
As of right now, yes. It might change. Next week, though, this is a real fun one. Arun, who hosts the committee program, the two of us will be on the Athens Riviera at a global left conference of some sort. And we'll be airing from there. So you definitely want to subscribe because we're going to be running around with like chasing down, you know, leftist prime ministers from Kosovo and other places I was promised because this is like a Arun's job and I'm just there to, you know, be his sidekick basically.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Are you there right now?
I am.
Whoa.
It's only 8:30 p.m. guys.
Wow.
That's the plan.
Nice. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're heading to the fun half, 646-257-3920. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to take some calls, but at the very least, we're going to read your IMs and talk about things in the news. Be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on. To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.